Welcome to Her Story, a project by Chick History. I'm your host, Rebecca Price. For 1 year, we asked 50 contemporary women to share the story of the historical woman who has inspired her. Join us every week for a new story of inspiration, from the headliners to the lesser-known gems.
Dust off the books, read all the letters, preserve with time, dig out the truth written between. Her hair's still brick, cannot be left behind. She shall not be forgotten.
Joining us today for her story number 31 is Bonnie Koenig. Bonnie is president of Going International, a resource for organizations of all types to help them more effectively engage internationally. Prior to beginning her consulting practice, she was the executive director of Zonta International, a women's service organization with members in 65 countries. Bonnie earned her MA in international relations from Yale University and has been listed in Who's Who in America since 1994. Her publications include the book Going Global, The Greater Good, Succeeding as a Nonprofit in the International Community, as well as numerous articles about the operations of nonprofit organizations. To learn more about Bonnie and her work, you can visit her website, goinginternational.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at Bonnie Koenig, and I'll spell that out. It's Bonnie, K-O-E-N-I-G. Bonnie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rebecca.
And which woman have you chosen to share with us today?
I've chosen to talk about Wangari Maathai. Wangari is Kenyan, and she's best known as the founder of the Green Belt Movement, which I'll talk about a little bit later on in our discussion. And she's also very well known because in 2004, she was the first African woman to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. And unfortunately, Wangari passed away in the end of last year, in 2011, from cancer. So she now is a historical figure.
Well, please tell us all a little bit about Wangari Maathai.
Wangari came from a poor Kenyan family, but she was lucky, as it was a family which believed in education for girls as well as boys. So she was able to go to both grammar school and high school in Kenya, although she had to make efforts and travel quite a ways to be able to do that. Then she had a second Menwe's lucky opportunity, and that she received her college education in the U.S. under a program in the Kennedy administration in the early 1960s to bring students from developing countries to the U.S. After she received that education in rural Kansas, of all places, but she said that it taught her a lot about the U.S. and it taught her a lot about how you approach different cultures, and she met a number of other international students through that network of students who came from this program, which started her off in terms of looking at the world. When she returned to Kenya, she became an academic in the School of Veterinary Medicine at the University College of Nairobi, which later became the University of Nairobi, and she also later earned her PhD in Germany. So she set many firsts for women in terms of her education and in terms of her early academic career. She married, and when her husband ran for parliament with what she later discovered were his empty promises of jobs he had no intention of keeping, she was the one who thought she had the obligation to those who voted for him. That and a number of other areas really set up a lot of tension between them, because it was unusual for her to want to have this academic career and want to be doing things on her own. And so they did end up divorcing in what was a very public and humiliating way for her, in terms of him identifying her as not being an obedient wife, and telling a lot of falsehoods about her. And unfortunately, as I said, making it a real public type of activity that she would have hoped, obviously, it wouldn't have been. And, you know, for whatever reasons he decided that was important to her career, to his career, it was very humiliating, unfortunately, for her. There was an interesting story when I was looking into more details about her biography vis-a-vis the way that she adjusted to that divorce. The divorce was very costly, you know, because of the fact that her husband decided to make it this public spectacle. She had to spend a lot of money on legal fees. And at the end of the divorce, she discovered she couldn't afford to live on her university salary, which was for women less than it was for men. So through some of the networks that she had developed and some of the work she was starting to do, she was offered a 6-month contract with a UN agency, but it was outside of Kenya. And at that time, she had children and she was concerned about her children. And the way that she decided to resolve that was the decision to leave them with her former husband, knowing that her relationship with the children might change dramatically because of leaving them with him. But despite everything, she really believed that their father loved them, and that relationship with the father was also very important. And on a personal note, I found that an interesting story because having watched a lot of couples, unfortunately, divorce, it's the rare individuals who can truly put their children first when choices or circumstances become difficult. So I found that a very admirable way to approach the situation. Moving on, in terms of her career, when she was growing up, she saw once fertile lands being overused to grow cash crops for export. And the result of that is many rural families were no longer able to feed their families, and the environment was being devastated for future generations. So this became very important to her in terms of a way to help both women and families to be able to provide for their families, both for this generation and future generation. So she tried some different ideas and had some failures until finally she settled on the idea of planting trees and creating local nurseries. And then in 1977, she founded what later became the Greenbelt Movement, which has as a major focus on planting trees, but it takes a very holistic approach to development by focusing on not just environmental conservation, but community development and capacity development and good governance. So although the Greenbelt Movement has focused very much on these nurseries and planting trees, and over the years it's created 6,000 local nurseries and has planted over 40 million trees in Kenya, which is quite an astonishing number. Its approach also was to look at society and look at various good governance aspects that would be important in terms of people having human dignity and having good lives. And as part of this approach, she and the Greenbelt Movement took on the corrupt government of President Daniel Arap Moi from the late 1970s all the way through his eventual defeat in 2002. And it was great personal risk to both her individually and members of the Greenbelt Movement, and often with very negative consequences, beatings to individual, jail time, et cetera. And she was in and out of jail, unfortunately, over that period of time. An interesting story that I found from this period of time of her life is that when the political harassment would force the Greenbelt Movement out of its offices, she housed the dozens of staff members in her own home. And when that harassment continued and sometimes would lead to soldiers surrounding the house, so that the Greenbelt Movement employees or those attending meetings in her house were fearful for their safety, she would house whatever numbers of people were with her for a meeting or for working on various projects. And so she said she always kept her house clean so that the floor space would be comfortable to those who might have to spend the night. And then I want to conclude just the summary of her life by talking about, despite the early defeats that she had in terms of running for office, she never thought of herself as necessarily someone who would be elected, but people encouraged her because she did become a spokesperson for good governance through the work she was doing. People did encourage her to run, and for a number of years she knew she'd be defeated because nominally, in many ways, Kenya was a one-party system. But she did persist, and in 2002, when Daniel Arap Moi's party was finally defeated, she was elected to parliament. And that then gave her an additional platform in terms of doing the good work that she always felt very strongly about.
And how has she affected you, or how has her work and her life influenced you, and what about her do you find to be inspirational?
Well, there's a few ways that I've been inspired by the work of someone like Wangari Maathai, and particularly Wangari Maathai. She was incredibly persistent. She challenged the assumptions about the roles of women throughout her career, from women not being able to receive certain benefits that men would, and her first academic position to, you know, people being, you know, astonished that, or, you know, never thinking in the culture that they could be members of parliament. And she was very courageous about it. She didn't shy away from going to jail to stand up for change. So over a number of decades, she was periodically arrested and put in small, filthy cells, which led to bad chronic arthritis. But, you know, the cause was something that she just persisted on, which is incredibly, you know, inspirational for those of us who haven't been in those kinds of situations where, you know, we all can be activists in one way or another, but some situations obviously are much more severe than others. And these are attributes that are true of many activists who we remember, but people who really inspire me, despite all the accolades that they may get at some later point in their career, they stay humble. And one of the things that really inspires me about Wangari is that she always acknowledged that the honors she received were about the message, not about her. And she didn't carry herself above others. And she didn't hesitate to continue to plant herself and get her hands and body literally dirty by working directly with other members of the Greenbelt movement in the field. And I think that that ability to, you know, walk with kings and princes, as the poem If by Rudyard Kipling goes, but still stay true to the common person, I think is just incredibly admirable. And she definitely had that ability to stay humble and in many ways not take herself too seriously. And from a movement perspective, so that's from a personal perspective in Wangari herself. From a movement perspective, one of the things that I think we can learn from the kind of work that she did with the Greenbelt movement is that the Greenbelt movement has taken an approach for decades that much of the international development community and many of us who do social impact work are just now either sort of discovering or rediscovering. So she had a very sort of basic skills and approaches to the way that they would bring about change that often is overlooked when we focus more on high tech and, you know, sort of more complex and complicated ways to do things. So as I mentioned, they had this very holistic approach. Even though they were focused on natural resource management, they realized that it had to be grounded in respect for human rights, respect for women, good economics, good governance. She invested in local groups. So there was always a sense that even though she was based in Nairobi, she came from a rural part of Kenya, and that it was really important for things to bubble up from those local groups and for the local groups to take responsibility for what they were doing and realize that that was the way that it was going to be sustainable and that the women would put in the time that they needed to. And she gave members autonomy to experiment with different ways of ensuring the survival of the seedlings that they were planted. And she would joke that they were farmers without diplomas, so that there was respect for anyone who was part of this, no matter how illiterate they might be and their lack of education, that they were given both respect for what they were doing and a fair amount of autonomy within the structure of the Greenbelt movement to do what they feel was best. And they were continuously examining what they were doing and looking to change and what didn't work. And recently we've had this move towards admitting failure, because a lot of our current organizations and Western organizations aren't always willing to do that. And that was something that she continuously felt was important. And then in terms of sustainability and how you scale something up, which is often also a challenge, and it often comes directly from sort of that central group, she felt it was very important for individual members to go to their neighbors and convince them to join, that it always had to be a very locally driven process, and it really had to be based on that very person-to-person type of activity. So both as an individual, I find her inspirational, but in terms of the movement that she herself inspired, I find that movement inspirational in terms of things that we can learn as well.
Bonnie, did you ever actually get to meet her in your work, especially with Zonta International?
I did have the opportunity to meet her, which is always obviously exciting and inspirational to meet someone that you've heard about on this level. Wangari mentioned that one of the people that she interacted with early in her career was a woman by the name of Helvi Sipola, who was one of the first high-level women at the UN, who's from Finland, and she was a past president of Zonta International. So we have that connection with Wangari. So I did have the opportunity at one point to go hear her speak when she was in the U.S. Unfortunately, didn't have the opportunity to talk to her at length, but it was wonderful, obviously, to be able to meet her in person.
Well, let's go ahead and wrap it up. And do you have one book that you would recommend so listeners can start learning more about her?
Yes, absolutely. If people are interested in learning more about Wangari, her memoir called Unbowed, a Memoir, that was written in, I believe, 2006, 2007, shares a lot more stories in terms of her personal history.
Well, there you have it for Wangari Mutai. Bonnie, thank you so much for sharing her story with us.
Thank you, Rebecca. It's been a pleasure.
To learn more about her story and other projects by Chick History, you can visit the website chickhistory.com. And please join us every week for another story of an inspirational woman in history.
I'm here to tell a story, something precious and fine, about a woman who made a difference with her life. She might not be known, but to only a few, her story remembered here is gonna change that view. Her history cannot be left behind. She shall not be forgotten. Her story not forgotten.